This is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, episode 26, Thanksgiving Day Q&A. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. In this episode, your Thanksgiving Day questions are answered. We're going to be talking to S.J. Dorse about Brussels sprouts. Brianne wants to know about turkey leg roulades and sous vide cooking. And Patricia will be spatchcocking a goose. Nina gives you tips. Mohammed has some troubleshooting questions all the way from Egypt. And Paul wants to know about cream of mushroom soup. All these topics and much more, so break out your chef coats and aprons. It's time to go to class. And this is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, found online. Found online at stellaculinary.com. Jacob Burton here, you know, the professional broadcaster who just booms into his mic right from the get-go. Just blowing out your eardrums. But that's okay. You guys don't care about my mic technique. You care about me answering your questions on Thanksgiving. So look, if you haven't listened yet to Stella Culinary School Podcast, episode 24 and 25, you may want to press the pause button and go back and listen to those first, because we discuss a lot of concepts and, you know, more than 2 hours combined in the last two podcasts talking all about Thanksgiving. So 24 was all about the turkey, 25 was all about the sides, and 26 is answering your questions to make sure that we're drilling home all these concepts and you understand them fully before the big day. Now, I'm not the kind of guy to leave you hanging. So this is why not only am I recording this podcast right now so you can have it before Thanksgiving, but I also placed a forum thread for your Thanksgiving Day questions, which I will be answering all the way up until Thursday morning. And I might even be answering some throughout the day on Thursday, depending upon how much time I have. I will be with my family and helping cook dinner, but I have a chance to step away and answer a question, especially if it's an emergency question. So I'll tell you what, if you send me a friend request on Facebook, because that's probably going to be the easiest way to dial your turkey 911, and here's how you're going to do it. Send me a friend request now. You can find me facebook.com/chefjacobburton. And then once I accept your friend request, I'll be looking for these. Or if you are my friend already, then don't worry about it. But then you'll have the ability to instant message me. And all in your instant message through Facebook by using the Facebook Messenger app will pop up on my cell phone. Now, I will be checking the forum thread sporadically, but if you run into an issue and you start panicking, go ahead and just shoot me a message on Facebook Instant Messenger, and I'd be happy to help you out. All right, because I'm dedicated to you, to helping you make an amazing Thanksgiving dinner. And I know that, from the feedback I've gotten, I've inspired quite a few of you to maybe try something a little bit outside the norm this year. Maybe you always whole roasted your turkey or you made your gravy a different way. And so this year you're like, you know what, Jacob, damn it. You convinced me to do my turkey like this. You convinced me to make my gravy like that. And so the last thing I want you to do is try this new concept for the first time on Thanksgiving Day and then run into a sticking point. You're like, what do I do now? So friend me on Facebook and feel free to message me on Thanksgiving Day. I'd be happy to help you out. And if it's not something that is super critical, then post it on the Stella Culinary Forum. And you can find it at, I'll put a link in this episode's show notes, stellaculinary.com/SCS26. Wow, we're pumping out so many episodes now. I almost lost track of the count. So yeah, stellaculinary.com/SCS26. And you can leave a comment directly there, or you can leave a comment in the forum, and I have a Thanksgiving Day link. And don't think that your comment needs to be a question. Tell us about a success. Tell us about a home run. Tell us what you're making and what your ideas are. I know people are going to want to share all of their ideas. this actually leads me to, we're going to go with Nina first, because in the Stella Culinary School forum, Nina actually shared the way that she does her turkey and has done it for years. And Nina says, this turkey recipe comes from Cook's Illustrated, November to December issue, 2011. Once we try this recipe, it is the only one we go back to. It begins with a 10 to 12 pound bird. Butcher the bird into breast, legs, thighs, back, and wings. And I forgot to ask her if she left it on the bone, but she might. If not, you can use the breakdown that I do, the breakdown video that I have linked in the show notes. But then they cover the bottom of the roasting pan with three chopped onions, three ribs of celery, and two carrots, some garlic, bay leaves, fresh thyme, and parsley. Put the back and the wings aside. All the other pieces get brushed with butter, sprinkle with salt and pepper. This goes uncovered into 500 degree Fahrenheit oven until the skin lightly browns at about the 20 minute mark. Remove the pan, knock the temp down to 325 degrees Fahrenheit. Pour in 1 cup of dry white wine and 4 cups of low sodium broth around the turkey pieces and add a 1/2 ounce of rinsed porcini mushrooms. That sounds delicious. Cover the pan with parchment paper topped with aluminum foil. Close the foil tightly around the pan and roast at about 1 1/3 to 2 1/4 hours, or until the breasts reach 160 degrees Fahrenheit and the thighs are 165 degrees Fahrenheit plus. So the wings and backs are used to actually top the pan holding the dressing. So she pokes 10 to 15 holes in each wings, browns the meat in a saucepan, and use your favorite stuffing recipe and add 2 cups of broth to the dressing. Place in a buttered casserole dish. Place the wings and back on top of the dressing. Like the turkey, wrap the dish in parchment and foil, and then the drippings add flavor as if it were stuffed in the bird. Now, that's brilliant. I love that. Those guys over at Cook's Illustrated, they're pretty smart guys. So basically what she's doing is she's getting some color on that turkey, roasting it on top of the vegetables and covering it, and they're finishing by steam. So that's why you add in the white wine and the broth. And what's nice about the 4 cups of chicken broth and the white wine is now you have the drippings from the bird and that have been flavored by the chopped up aromatics. And it's just going to give you this really nice cooking liquid at the end that you can use to make your gravy just by stirring in your roux. So for more details on that, check out this episode's show notes, because I'll put a link to that, again, that form question. And thank you, Nina, for that response. That's a great share. Up next is SJ Dorst, who says, I had your Brussels sprouts at Stella on Thanksgiving Day 2012. They were divine, and the memory lingers. I'd like to do them for my family this year. Please, 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 please provide the recipe. All right, so the recipe for this is pretty straightforward, and really what it is, it's all about your technique and the sauce. Technique side, the reason why people do not like Brussels sprouts is because they have sulfur compounds in them, just like eggs. And as you continue to cook the Brussels sprouts, the sulfur compounds continue to break down and become stronger and stronger and stronger, which is why Brussels sprouts, when you just boil the hell out of them, will taste like rotten eggs, which is why people hate them so much. So for Brussels sprouts, you really want to do a two-step cooking process. You do a blanching step, and then you do a finishing step. So for your blanching step, bring a pot of boiling salted water to a boil, and then add in your Brussels sprouts whole. I'll cut off the woody stem end of the Brussels sprouts, but I'll still blanch them whole. And you want to blanch them or boil them in this salted water for maybe about 3 to 4 minutes, but basically you want to check their tenderness by just poking them with a knife. And when you can take a paring knife and just stick it in the center of that Brussels sprout and pull it out relatively easily, but before it becomes mushy, then you want to chill them rapidly in an ice water bath. And we have an entire episode, Stella Culinary School Podcast Episode 4 talks all about blanching, and I get really into the science about it. So if you have questions on that, I would refer to that episode. But once the Brussels sprouts are blanched, chilled, set aside, then you want to finish them off later. And you use a high heat cooking technique to brown the Brussels sprouts and generate some flavor. So at home, a lot of times what I will do is I will sear the Brussels sprouts. I'll cut them in half, and I'll sear them cut side down in a saute pan. And then once they caramelize on that cut side, then I'll just saute them around a little bit, throwing some shallots and some walnuts and toast those walnuts up. Now, the walnuts can be as is and just kind of toasted along with your Brussels sprouts, or they can be candied first. And we discussed candying in a Ask Chef Jacob episode, but for basically for candying nuts in general, you just want to make a glaze by thinning powdered sugar with water and lemon juice. So just as, you know, thin enough so it sticks to the nuts, and then lay them out on an even tray, bake at 325 for 5 minutes, give them a stir and bake for about another 5 minutes. But check them because your nuts will go from perfectly candied to burnt really fast. So you could add those candied nuts to the Brussels sprouts as well, or you can just do the toasted walnuts. And what really makes this Brussels sprout dish nice is the dressing, really. So to finish, we have, again, the Brussels sprouts that we seared, then we added the shallots and the walnuts. We sauteed that around a little bit until they all kind of got yummy and, you know, got a chance to know each other. Then you place it in a mixing bowl. I'll add some chopped curly leaf parsley and some capers, just because I think it gives a nice zing. Make sure you season with some salt and some black pepper. And then I'll dress it with my honey anchovy aioli. And this aioli, just like it sounds, has honey and anchovies and garlic. And just think of it as like a sweet, tangy Caesar dressing almost. And when you coat the Brussels sprouts with it, it's absolutely awesome. Now, if you want to get real sinister, go ahead and add in some bacon as well. In fact, what you would do if you're going to add some bacon is you dice the bacon up, render the bacon fat out before you sear the Brussels sprouts. Then you sear the Brussels sprouts in the residual bacon fat. Hell yeah. And then saute everything around. Add the bacon back into the mixing bowl at the end with the capers and the chopped parsley, and then coat with this honey anchovy emulsion. And I'm going to put a link in the show notes to this recipe. And this recipe will make a car bumper taste good. So just do your Brussels sprouts however you like. Now, at the restaurant, we would deep fry them just because it gives you a more even crisping and, you know, better overall texture, in my opinion. However, pan frying is great. You can also, too, if you have the oven space, now remember, your oven probably is going to be crowded on Thanksgiving Day, so you might want to do it on a stovetop. But if you have the oven space, you can put a sheet tray in your oven at 425 degrees Fahrenheit, 450, and let it heat for maybe like 20 minutes. Then you pull it out of the oven, coat your Brussels sprouts very, very lightly so that they've already been blanched. You've dried the Brussels sprouts just by kind of laying them out on a paper towel after you cut them in half. And then you want to coat them in just a tiny bit of cooking oil and then lay them cut side down on the preheated sheet tray. Pop them back in your oven, and it'll maybe take, I don't know, 15 minutes at this point to cook them golden brown. But I would start checking them at around the 10-minute mark. Ovens are all different, and it depends on, you know, what kind of sheet tray you're using, so I don't know. I'd say maybe 10 minutes. Give them a check. And you're just looking to brown them. And once they're brown, you pull them out and go ahead and you know, mix them with your nut of choice, the chopped parsley, capers, and your honey anchovy aioli. All right, Brianne's question is up next. And her first question is about a turkey breast roulade. And she says, when breaking down the turkey and removing the breast, it's difficult to keep the skin on. If I simply remove the skin and create a roulade with the breast, could I use transglutaminase to adhere the skin back to the rolled up breast? All right, so transglutaminase is a meat enzyme that will bind proteins together. And you can actually, it's naturally occurring in your blood. It's part of what makes your scab form, right? So if you cut yourself and you form a scab, the transglutaminase enzyme is part of that process. So you can use a refined version, pure transglutaminase, and it comes under the brand name of Activa RM or Activa GS. There's a couple other ones as well, but the two main forms that you're going to see is Activa RM and Activa GS. RM is mainly used for red meat. I'm not really sure why, because GS works on red meat as well. And the problem with RM is it oxidizes pretty rapidly at room temperature when it's exposed to air. So when you use the Activa RM, you have about a 20-minute window to get done what you need to get done. So like roll your roulade, form your terrine, whatever, and then wrap it in plastic wrap or vacuum pack it before and chill it down before the Activa RM has a chance to oxidize. Whereas Activa GS is a little bit more shelf-stable. All right, so what Brianne's talking about doing is taking the turkey breast, possibly pounding it out a little bit, and then rolling it back up and then making it hold its shape with, you know, so you can slice medallions after you cook it sous vide. And maybe taking the skin and gluing the skin back on. Now, the problem with the gluing the skin on is I have seen this done successfully before, but in my opinion, it's usually a little bit more effort than it's worth unless you're doing this for a super novel dish in a high-end restaurant that you're charging a lot of money for. And it, because fat will not adhere to with transglutaminase. So you can't bind fat together with transglutaminase. You need proteins. So the way that usually around this is they'll take the skin and a lot of times blanch it first to remove some fat and then scrape the underside of the skin to remove most of the subcutaneous fat. And then they'll try and glue the skin back on. But for Thanksgiving, I think it's way too much trouble. So what you could do instead is you could actually, if you want, you could take that breast, you can roll it up into a roulade. And I'm going to put a link to my two different chicken roulade videos in this episode's show notes, because that'll give you a good idea of the method that I would use. And this roulade is universal, so it'll work with anything, especially turkey breast. Just this turkey breast is the exact same thing as chicken breast, just larger. So I'll put a link there. But then what you could do, so I would do the roulade skinless, and it's going to come out beautiful sous vide. And then with that piece of skin, you can sandwich in between two pieces of parchment paper, lay on a sheet tray, and then place another sheet tray on top. And then you bake it at 350, 375 for maybe 20 minutes until a lot of that fat is rendered out of the skin. So the sheet tray on top with a piece of parchment paper, kind of sandwiching it down, is going to keep it from curling up during the initial stages of baking. Once you've rendered out that fat and it's kind of flattened out and it's started to cook after the 20-minute mark, you can remove that top sheet tray, remove that top piece of parchment paper, and then, you know, maybe sprinkle with some salt at this stage. The salt will stick and help season it. And then continue to bake until it's a crisp golden brown. Now you can take this large flat piece of crispy turkey skin and you could either serve it as is, you could break it up, or you can just hide in the corner and munch on it like as a snack. You know, as a bonus for all your hard work for cooking turkey for everybody on Thanksgiving, right? That's what I would do. I would just go hide in the corner like it's a stolen item and just, you know, just gnaw on it. So, but yeah, there's ways around that. So you could use that for a garnish. So when using transglutaminase to make your roulade, you're going to powder the inside of the turkey breast, so opposite the skin side. So the skin side is going to be on the outside of your roulade. So you powder the inside. You're going to want to pound your chicken your turkey breast a little bit to flatten it out and make it more even. Roll it up and then form a roulade using plastic wrap. Now, at this point, you can vacuum pack it and let it chill in your fridge, or you can just drop it directly into your circulator. Now, the way that this enzyme activates is in two ways. Either over time, when oxygen is removed from the environment, so after you want to wrap it up in plastic wrap and let it sit overnight, then you can take that turkey roulade and it'll still be raw, and you can cut medallions from it, and it'll almost look like a filet mignon. So it'll be one cohesive piece of meat. However, the enzyme is also hyperactivated at 60 degrees Celsius, which is convenient because that's the exact same temperature, or 140 degrees Fahrenheit, is the exact same temperature that we sous vide the turkey breast at. So if you're going to sous vide it anyways, you would just take that, you would take the roulade right after you roll it up, drop it in your circulating bath, and that temperature is going to hyperactivate the enzyme and allow it to set together. Now, Brianne has a follow-up question. She said, I just listened to your turkey podcast, which is episode 24. I have two questions related to sous vide. One, if I want to make a roulade with the breast suggested by Mucho, would this change the cook time? Or because the cook time is so long anyways, 4 hours, it shouldn't make much of a difference? And the answer is nope, doesn't make much of a difference. Because the cook time is so long, it doesn't really make a difference whether the breast is flat or if it's rolled up into a cylinder when making a roulade. My second question, she says, has to do with the type of turkey cooked. I am cooking a fresh organic, not my choice. Well, that's okay. Fresh organic is awesome. There's nothing wrong. It's like, hey, that's not my choice. There's nothing, no shame in cooking a fresh organic turkey for Thanksgiving. I have heard that in traditional methods that this type of turkey cooks a lot faster. Does the sous vide immersion circulator cooking differ here as well? If so, need the times for both breast and dark meat. Okay. No, and that's one of the great things about sous vide cooking. Now, where the argument comes from, saying, hey, the fresh organic turkey, you know, it's going to dry out faster than your normal turkey, is because those turkeys, the true pasture-raised turkeys, are allowed to actually roam around and get exercise. And when animals are allowed to exercise, they burn off fat and they build up connective tissue. So they're going to have less fat, and fat will keep meat moist during the cooking process, and they're going to build up a little bit more connective tissue. Not massive amounts, but enough to where you have just a little bit less fat, a little more connective tissue. So if you're less precise with your cooking, then you could run into some issues of with dryness, right? And, you know, even people who buy the big fatty farm-raised turkeys, you know, they're constantly running into issues with their dryness because turkey is just kind of a lean bird in general. But that's why sous vide technology is so awesome, because as long as you keep it set at that temperature, you're not going to overcook it. And the cooking temperature of 145 degrees Fahrenheit for the legs and 140 degrees Fahrenheit for the breast are far below the fiber drying temperatures of 155 degrees Fahrenheit. So you're going to be able to cook your turkey all the way through and make it safe to eat by holding it at that temperature. Again, 4 hours for the breast, 4 to 6 hours for the leg, and you're going to be cooking it at temperatures below the point where they dry out. So you're going to have a beautiful, organic, and juicy turkey for Thanksgiving. My contribution be most definitely political, subliminal, partially, hardly any filler of that about the process. I'm thinking progress over literary garbage, harness. These words sicken me, the future set. I regret even when dealing with the corporate structure. Power is given up to those who... All right, next up is Patricia, and Patricia is spatchcocking a goose for Thanksgiving. So she says, I am cooking your spatchcock roast goose for Thanksgiving. How many minutes per pound? Recipe doesn't say, and I need to know for planning purposes. Thanks. I love your website a lot, Patricia. Or, wait, is it Patricia or Patrice? I never know what these things. I don't know. So if I'm pronouncing your name wrong, I apologize. So my method for spatchcocking goose would go a little bit something like this. First of all, it'd be the same thing as we talked with the turkey. So take out the breastbone. Lay the goose flat, tuck the wingtips behind the shoulders. Again, you can reference my chicken video on this where I demonstrate this technique with chicken. And then you want to give the skin the boiling water treatment. So bring about a gallon of water to the boil, and then using a large ladle, just ladle that boiling water all over that skin. So you have the goose probably laid on a sheet tray. Ladle some of the water over the skin, pour off the excess water, and then continue to ladle until that gallon of water is completely gone. And this is especially important with goose and duck, because goose and duck skin contain a lot more fat and a lot more collagen than turkey or chicken skin. So the boiling water treatment is really, really important. Next, you want to salt, 1% salt by the weight of the goose. So just weigh the goose, measure out 1% salt based upon that weight, and then salt both sides, the skin side and the inside. Then go ahead and just let it sit in your fridge overnight, uncovered, so the skin is exposed to dry air and allowed to dry out slightly. Now your next step is you want to actually, instead of blasting this in a hot oven like I normally do with my turkey and my chicken, now you can. I've done this with goose and duck before, and you can just blast it in a hot oven and it'll come out fine. But if you really want that extra special crispy skin, here's the step that you want to take. Place your goose the next day on a wire rack and place a little bit of water in the bottom of that roasting pan or that sheet tray just to create some steam, and that'll keep the fat from scorching as well. So as the fat drips down into that pan, if that pan dries out too much and gets too hot, it'll scorch and create some smoke. Now, over a long enough period of time, that smoke can actually flavor the bird and make it taste like, you know, scorched bird. If you've ever smelled how, like, when your oven gets too dirty and you turn your oven on to roast something like at 450 degrees Fahrenheit and it starts smoking and you have that, like, that acrid smoke smell, well, if you expose food to that for long enough, then your food will taste like that, which is not what you want. So a little bit of water in the bottom of your pan will keep that from happening. And it'll also generate some steam, which will give you a little bit of a moister cooking environment. Now, you place this into a 225 degree Fahrenheit oven. That's like 109 degrees Celsius, something around there. And you want to monitor it with an internal probe thermometer. with a lead attachment that's set at 155 degrees Fahrenheit. And you want to monitor this either in the breast or the leg and thigh, because really when you spatchcock, it doesn't make much of a difference because it's going to cook at the same relative speed because the meat is flat. So when your alarm beeps at you at 155 degrees Fahrenheit, you want to pull the goose out of the oven and let it rest, and let it rest minimum down to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, minimum 110, but better 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, while it's resting, turn your oven up to 475, 500, really as kind of almost as high as it goes, but 450 to 500 is good. At this point, the goose has a lot of fat still locked up in its skin. So when you pull the goose out of the oven, you set it aside to rest as you turn up your oven. But now your goose has only rested for maybe, say, you know, a couple of minutes, right? You want to take either a cake tester or a needle or some sort of very fine-tipped instrument. So a needle works if you have a brining needle or a cake tester. And what you want to do is while that goose is still hot, you want to puncture it all over just skin side deep. And what you'll see is you'll have this fat kind of percolate out of the skin. And then, so you have this fat percolating out of the skin. You want to take a paintbrush that obviously doesn't have any paint on it, or just a basting brush, really, something that is, you know, food safe. And all this skin that is now, you know, percolating out of, or all of that fat that is now percolating out of your skin, you want to brush it all over the duck. So this is going to be basting the duck with its own fat. Then when the duck drops to 110 degrees Fahrenheit, or the goose drops to 110 degrees Fahrenheit internal temperature, and your oven is at 450 to 500 degrees, then you're going to pop that bad boy back into the oven and just blast it until that skin is a crisp, dark, golden brown. Now, if you have a convection fan, you want to use it because the convection fan is going to help circulate the hot air in the oven. And just kind of check your bird every, say, you know, 5 to 10 minutes. And if it starts to cook faster or brown faster on the back, then you want to flip it around so you even it out. And you could even give it a couple more brushings as that fat continues to percolate to the surface. And that's going to give you a really beautifully cooked goose with amazingly crispy skin. And again, you can just blast it at high heat like we talked about in SES episode 24 when we were talking about spatchcocking our turkey. You can use the exact same method for goose, but that low and slow start and that rest is going to help to really render that fat out of the skin. Then bring that fat to the surface when you poke the holes to lacquer the skin, which is going to allow it to crisp. And it's going to just give you a better end product. Again, because the skin of duck and goose is thicker, contains more collagen, it contains more fat than a traditional turkey or chicken. So adding that extra step is just going to give you a better end product. And you know what? A lot of people like to do goose and duck for Christmas. So I will shoot a video on spatchcock goose before Christmas, and I will walk you through this process because this is a really great process to do. So Patrice or Patricia, I wrote your name down two different ways in my notes. Good luck and let me know how it turns out. All right, so our next question comes from Mohammed from Egypt, and he says in response to episode 24, perfect lesson, but I'd like to ask about an irritable comment I got from our guest who we served a whole turkey stuffed with rice and turkey's liver and nuts. We marinated the whole turkey and then roasted in a dry oven for 2.5 hours. But we got a comment that the turkey had a greasy taste. And I'd like to ask you about the greasy taste in the meat. Is the reason due to the turkey feeding food or not? We feed it on raw eggs in Egypt. Really? You feed turkey on raw eggs in Egypt? Huh. Yeah, you know, I don't know. So he gives me his marinade recipe, which seems pretty standard. Thyme, rosemary, garlic clove, salt, black pepper, vegetable oil, orange zest, lemon juice, lemon zest, and orange zest. The turkey is marinated in the fridge for 8 to 16 hours and then stuffed with rice, half-cooked with the turkey giblets, roasting in steam oven for 180. Okay, so If your turkey is coming out tasting greasy, it could just be the bird. I've never heard of them actually feeding turkeys raw eggs. That's very interesting. So I don't know if maybe that's something I got wrong in translation or if they actually do feed turkeys raw eggs in Egypt. Now, for a greasy flavor, I would, first of all, looking at your marinade, there's a couple of things that bug me about it. Number one is the citrus zest. Now, citrus zest is great. So is garlic cloves. But both, in my experience, lemon zest, orange zest, and garlic cloves, they all burn relatively quickly. So if you have any of that clinging to your turkey while you're cooking it, that will give it a, it could give it a burnt flavor. And as that turkey continues to cook, that burnt flavor can actually turn into a greasy flavor as it mixes with the turkey fat and the vegetable oil that's in the marinade. So that could be causing it. Now, there's a lot of different like spice rubs and things like that for turkeys. But for me, I think a minimalist approach is almost always best. Now, there's going to be somebody out there who can prove me wrong with an awesome turkey rub or an awesome turkey marinade. But if that's the case, then you don't need my help anyways, right? But for the vast majority of people, I think a big stumbling block is they really want to make their turkey more fancy than it should be. And when it comes to a great turkey, you really want that purity and flavor and that juiciness and tenderness. So you have to realize that a tender juice, truly, truly tender and juicy. Now, there is completely horrible over-dried stringy turkey, okay? And then there's that turkey that's served by somewhat decent and competent cooks that isn't egregiously dry, but it's definitely not perfect. And then there's beautifully moist, tender, juicy turkey. And that is a true novelty to most people. Unless they themselves really know how to cook, or they themselves have someone in their lives that knows how to cook turkey amazingly well. Because turkey is very unforgiving. It's incredibly lean, and it dries out really, really quick. And the fact that it's so large adds that extra level of complexity that you need to deal with, which is why I like to either flatten the turkey by spatchcocking, or better yet, breaking it down. Because now I've taken this large bird that cooks very unevenly and tends to dry out, and I've broken it down into smaller individual parts that are then easier to deal with. Then to continue on with this theme of that purity of flavor, I dry salt with our 1% salt ratio, which is going to help to maintain that moisture during the cooking process. Now, then you serve this alongside with a really nice stuffing and a beautiful reduced gravy that you made using a homemade stock. And you're going to have a really nice play on turkey and gravy. I would omit the marinade on your turkey because I think that's probably what's giving you problems. And a good sort of control for this, to control for the actual quality of the bird, is take one of your turkeys, cut off a breast, and pan roast the breast as I demonstrated in my video. So just do a little salt, pan roast it, and then eat it. And if that breast, after pan roasting, kind of tastes greasy and strange and off, then it's most likely the quality of your bird. But if it tastes fine, then it's your marinade, and I would recommend cooking the turkey separately. So breaking it down and cooking it separately and then recombining on the plate during dinner service. Because Mohammed, he is from Egypt and he's working in a restaurant. So I don't know if I mentioned that. So in a restaurant environment, I'm always going to handle my proteins separately and then recombine them on the plate right before serving. So it's going to give me a lot more control over those variables. Paul's up next, and Paul's question is, I want to make scratch cream of mushroom soup for a green bean casserole. Any pointers? Well, thanks, Paul. You got right to the point, huh? I love that. So yeah, so Paul, a cream of mushroom soup, which you can buy the condensed version, and the condensed version is pretty classic to be used in a green bean casserole. But if you want to go more scratch, instead of using the canned green beans, which are always just gray and kind of, they cook the hell out of them, and then canned condensed soup, you can do it from scratch by making your own cream of mushroom soup and then blanching French green beans. So I'll walk you through that process really quick. Cream of mushroom soup is really nothing more than bechamel with mushrooms added. So you would take your mushrooms. I would personally saute them just because they're going to get more flavor. So chop the mushrooms up, cut them into slices, cut them into quarters, depending upon what kind of texture you want. because you're mixing it for a green bean casserole, I probably do thin slices because that's going to disperse the mushrooms more evenly throughout the casserole. But who knows, some large chunks might be nice as well. So next, make a bechamel. And when you make your bechamel, I'm going to put a link in the show notes, but bechamel is basically it's the basic French mother sauce that is milk-based. So white roux plus milk equals bechamel. And I have a video on this. So I'll put a link to that video and a link to the recipe in the show notes. And then once your bechamel is done, add your mushrooms. And I would probably add another, say, pint of milk. So 16 ounces of milk. And then I would simmer very gently. I would simmer that 16 ounces of milk out. Now also, too, instead of adding milk, you could actually add turkey stock. So you have your bechamel, which is milk-based, right? Follow me here. You finish your bechamel, which takes about 20 minutes from start to finish. Now to that bechamel, which is the perfect consistency based upon the roux that you had, you're going to thin that bechamel with turkey stock or chicken stock. So now it's thin again. This gives you the opportunity to add in your mushrooms and then simmer your mushrooms in that bechamel while reducing it. So you're going to reduce out that pint of stock that you added in. Now, while you're reducing out that pint of stock, the water's evaporating, but all the flavors from that stock are concentrating while your mushroom flavor is infusing into your bechamel. So now you have this beautiful cream of mushroom soup. And for a standard casserole pan, you're probably going to want a couple pounds of French green beans and maybe like 1 to 2 pounds. I don't know. It's hard to tell. And to coat that, to play it safe, I don't know. Let's call it 2 quarts of bechamel. I think 1 quart's going to do it. But here's the deal. With that extra quart, you can take that that now very flavorful bechamel that has your turkey or chicken stock in it, and you can use that to make chicken pot pie later on. I'm going to actually talk about that in a culinary quick tip. But you're probably going to need minimum quart of bechamel, and you'll have a little bit left over. Take your French green beans, clean off the ends, and I have a video on how to clean and blanch French green beans, so I'll put that in the show notes as well. And then you want to combine them with your bechamel, and then maybe add in just a little bit of breadcrumb, just a tiny bit to help bind it a little bit, but you don't have to do a lot, and that's optional. And then bake it in your oven, probably 325 for an hour, but don't overthink this step, okay? What you're doing is you're just combining the green beans and the bechamel, and you're cooking until the green beans get to know the bechamel and are tender. Now, to be a super legit OG culinary gangster, what you're going to do is finish with your homemade crunchy onions, right? And look at the stuff that comes out of the can. Not only is it delicious, but it's also tradition. So nobody is going to be mad at you for using the canned crispy onions, right? But if you want to really take it to the next level, here's how you do it. You take your yellow or white onion, cut it really thin on a mandolin. And if your onion is too wide, you can just cut that in half. And then slice it really thin on a mandolin, and then soak in buttermilk for a minimum half hour, but you can soak it overnight. And it's going to soften these strips and kind of take away the harshness of that onion. Now you want to take a bowl, a mixing bowl, add in enough AP flour, all-purpose flour, to coat these onions in batches. And you're going to season this AP flour with Lowry's seasoning salt and Hidden Valley Ranch packet and a little bit of white pepper. Trust me on this one. Also throw in some paprika. The paprika gives it a really nice color. All right. Now, how much Lowry's and how much ranch? Who knows? I mean, I do it by sight. So add it in. They're both kind of salty, but just add it in. And if in doubt, just fry a single onion first and you can adjust the seasoning by adding more. Okay. But just stir in the Lowry's, stir in a little bit of a ranch packet. And I tend to use a 2-to-1 mixture of Lowry's to ranch. Now also too, you could do just straight unseasoned flour, and then when the onions come out of the hot oil, which we'll talk about in a second, then you just dust immediately with the 2-to-1 mixture of Lowry's and Hidden Valley Ranch. So either way, take your onions, coat them in the flour dredge, and then you want to fry them at 390 degrees Fahrenheit until they're a crispy golden brown. I like to do this in a wok. And so again, admittedly, this is another, you know, this is an extra step that you're taking, but it's going to be so good. It's going to be so good. So if you have the time and the stove space to do it, man, it'll be worth it. And then you just drain the onions when they're crispy and brown on a paper towel and spread the onions out in an even layer so they're not really stacked on top of each other. If they get stacked on top of each other, the residual heat is going to steam and make them uncrispy. Then when your green bean casserole is done, you take these onions, you pop them right on top, and you put it the whole thing back in your oven for another 10 minutes just to warm it cohesively. And are you kidding me? Scratch-made green bean casserole with scratch-made cream mushroom soup and crispy fried onions on top with the secret seasoning of Lowry's and ranch, which is so, so good. I know people out there don't believe me, but trust me, if I was a smarter guy, I would take this Lowry's and ranch, this 2-to-1 mixture, I'd mix it together like in, you know, pallet form, bottle it and sell it, because it is really one of the best all-purpose seasonings out there, especially for fried food and for dredges. So if you're going to batter fry anything, or you're going to dredge anything in flour, or if you're going to, say, like make some seasoned JoJo potatoes, it makes an awesome like French fry seasoning hot out of the fryer. Really, really good stuff. So, you know, that's how you take your green bean casserole to the next level there, Paul. So let me know how it turns out. Mucho Bocho, forum member extraordinaire, SES community member, guide. I mean, this guy, he's great on the forums. He chimes in and says, way to break the ice, Jacob, with a brand new website and great new content. The video was quick, informative, and easy to follow. He was talking about the turkey videos. Was it shot recently? Either way, looks like Chef has been spending time in the kickboxing ring. Way to wrap up 2015. Glad to be along for the ride. Thanks, Mucho. Yeah, I didn't notice until I was editing the videos, but if you look at my turkey series videos, I have bruises all up and down my arms, and those bruises are called monkey bites. When I was a kid, from about the age, really young, I did martial arts. I did a couple different forms of karate, just kind of dabbled in it a little bit, and then when I got into junior high and high school, I got really serious into Japanese jiu-jitsu. And it was a lot of fun, and I loved it. You know, it was kind of my sport that I played as a kid. Then I went off to college and then culinary school. 13 years later and 100 pounds heavier, I hadn't been on the mat for 13 years, right? So I decided to take up Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is more of a ground-oriented system. So instead of being on the feet, you're focus mainly on the ground, and they're constantly grabbing your arms and trying to twist them and break them and grabbing your gi and pulling you around the mat and throwing you. So as people grab you, they're basically pinching your skin underneath the gi, which forms these bruises, and it really is a lot of fun. So anyways, I started going recently, and in the last, I started in September, it's almost the end of November now, and I'm down 60 pounds just by doing some Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and finally getting my diet in order. I got my diet under track. So yeah, I've never felt better, even though my arms look like I've been in a car crash. But yes, thanks for noticing the bruises, Mucho. And that's why if you watch my turkey videos, you will see bruises all up and down my arms. Labradors, another longtime Stella Culinary Community member, chimes in and says, not necessarily just for Thanksgiving, but try something other than the gooey, sticky marshmallow sweet potatoes. Many years ago, I saw this recipe for spicy stuffed sweet potatoes in an unlikely place. For me, it's Vegetarian Times magazine. Oh, sacrilege. Just kidding. I love you vegetarians. Since then, I'll often bake a sweet potato and, along similar lines, mashing some butter and some spices into it. Sometimes I'll use my homemade curry powder. Tonight, it was cumin, garlic powder, and cinnamon. So delicious. And that's a great tip, and I love sweet potatoes. They have such an amazing flavor. They're good mashed. They're great in soups. They're supposed to be really healthy for you, too. Lots of vitamins and minerals. But Labrador's in his comment put a link to that recipe, so you'll be able to find that in this episode's show notes. So if you want to maybe switch things up a little bit, or maybe just have another potato side to go along with your traditional mashed potatoes, check out Labrador's take on the stuffed sweet potatoes and see what you think. All right, Simon's up next. Simon says, Thanksgiving Day gravy. Question for your upcoming podcast. It's 3 a.m. your time, so hopefully I'm in time. Looks like you made it. If I spatchcock the turkey, I'm guessing lots more flavorful cooking juices and fats will be available. How can I incorporate these into your cook-ahead gravy without compromising its sheen and consistency? Thanks a million, Simon. All right, Simon, so that's a great question. So first of all, what you can do is, again, when you spatchcock the turkey, you're taking out the backbone, and ideally you're going to allow it to dry out in your fridge overnight. So this is going to give you time to make a small batch of turkey stock with the backbone that you can roast. Now, as far as the drippings that come from the turkey during the roasting process, and the fond that is generated on that on the bottom of that pan during the roasting process is pretty easy. So you have your gravy that you already made ahead of time. Pour your juices off once your turkey is finished spatchcocking. You want to pour that into preferably a gravy separator. So again, it's that thing that looks like a measuring cup with the nozzle. Now take the gravy separator and let it sit. Allow the fat to rise to the top, pour off the turkey juices, and you can pour those turkey juices directly into your gravy. And then just simmer it a little bit, because again, those turkey juices are not going to be thick, so they're going to dilute your gravy a little bit. So add the turkey juices, bring your gravy up to a simmer. Now, in that same roasting pan that now has that fond on the bottom of the turkey, and the turkey has been removed and set aside to allow it to cool, pour your turkey fat that's been separated from the juices using the gravy separator back into that pan and roast some vegetables, okay? So some carrots, celery, onions, and then deglaze with a little bit of white wine or water. And you want to scrape that fond off the bottom of the pan and reduce it down to almost nothing, all right? And then when you have just a small thin layer of moisture on the bottom of your roasting pan, take those vegetables along with that reduced deglazing liquid, add that into your gravy, bring to a simmer, and simmer briefly. You know, I mean, 10 minutes is good. 20 minutes is going to give you a little bit more flavor extraction. And just simmer gently to bring your gravy back down to its final consistency. So as soon as your gravy hits that final consistency, because again, you're adding the turkey juices back in, and then you're giving it more flavor by roasting some aromatics in the turkey fat and reintroducing that with its deglazing liquid. So you're adding more flavor, but you're also adding more liquid to your gravy, which is going to thin it. So then you just want to gently simmer, watch for any scum that may rise to the surface, and then pass through a fine mesh strainer to get off, you know, get out all those extra vegetables and any aromatics. Return back to your stove, and then you will go through the finishing steps of adding a couple ounces of cream, bringing it back to a simmer, and then finishing with a little squeeze of lemon juice, and then tasting for salt, and possibly adding a little bit of salt and some white pepper. So that's how I would do it. I would still make the gravy ahead of time, and then you can reincorporate all those roasting juices that come out of the turkey right at the last second. So in today's culinary quick tip, I am going to give you two tips, really, for utilizing your Thanksgiving Day leftovers. So the first one is to make a turkey pot pie. And this is actually going to be a lot simpler than you think. And so the way you want to do this is go get yourself some frozen peas, maybe even some frozen corn, and dice up some mirepoix. And really, the smaller the better. So carrots, celery, onions, dice that up, and you want to saute that at the bottom of a large skillet. Now, this is just you're making your flavor base. So you saute it around, maybe brown it slightly. When a fond generates on the bottom of the pan, so the bottom of the pan starts to brown, deglaze it with about a cup or two of white wine or water. Scrape that fond and reduce your deglazing liquid until it's almost completely gone. From here, you can add in your frozen peas, frozen carrots, and really you're just adding it by sight, okay, to kind of give it a good mixture. Now, you take that leftover gravy that you have, which is going to be a perfect binder for your pot pie, and add your gravy in. Mix that in, and you may want to thin with a little bit of store-bought chicken stock. And this is all just personal preference. So if you'd like a really thick, like stick-to-your-bones filling, then you might just want to use your gravy as is. But when you melt in that gravy, and you don't want vegetables swimming in your gravy. You want to have a good mix of lots of vegetables and the gravy just kind of like coating the vegetables. At least that's my personal preference. So add your gravy a couple of spoonfuls at a time. And if it looks too thick, add a little bit of liquid, preferably stock. If it looks too thin, then just reduce a little bit until it reaches the consistency that you want. When your gravy has reduced to almost its final consistency, now you just take all your leftover turkey meat that's diced up into small little, you know, bite-sized chunks. Maybe let's call it, you know, half-inch chunks. And throw it into your gravy, mix it around, and then adjust. You might need to add another spoonful or two of gravy to make sure all your ingredients are coated. And then you want to place this in a casserole dish. Now, you can place this in a pie tin, but, you know, no need to go out and buy a pie tin. If you have, a glass pie mold, that works, casserole dish. Or if you're making this in a cast iron pan, you could even just leave it all right in there. Now, if I'm in a restaurant, I'm going to do a bottom crust to my pot pie because I'm making individual servings, right? So I'm going to get like a big, large ramekin. And to do that bottom crust, you're going to take your pie dough, press it into that bottom crust, line it with a piece of parchment paper, and fill that crust with either dried beans or baking beads to weigh it down. And you'll bake at about 350, 375 for maybe 15 to 20 minutes just until that pie crust is a very light golden brown and set. This is going to allow you to put your pot pie filling inside that crust and then, you know, place a top on and then bake without it sogging out on you. But for me, that is just way too much work after Thanksgiving, right? I mean, come on, give yourself a break. You've been cooking all week. You've been doing all this research, listening to these podcasts and thinking about your Thanksgiving all week long. Give yourself a break. Give yourself an easy win. Just skip the undercrust, okay? Skip the bottom crust. It's not a big deal. So just place your filling directly into a casserole pan or anything that will hold it. Then you want to make a very simple 3-2-1 pie crust. And so that means by weight, 3 parts flour, 2 parts fat, and 1 part ice water. And I'll put a link to this in the show notes. And the easiest way to do this is take your all-purpose flour and combine it with your butter that's nice and cold. So you want to make sure it's cold because that's how you get a flaky pie crust. Combine it with your butter in a food processor if you have one. Okay, so just a couple of pulses. But you want small chunks of butter dispersed throughout your pie crust. If you blend it too much, you're going to break down the butter and the butter is not going to give you that flaky pie crust anymore. It's going to incorporate. So after you've pulsed the cubed butter into your flour a couple times in your food processor, then you want to just stream in your ice cold water. And for me, for a decent sized batch, that's going to give me a nice top crust for to fill, you know, to line a large casserole pan. I'm going to do 300 grams of flour, 200 grams of butter, and 100 grams of ice cold water. Now, once you mix all this together, you want to wrap it in plastic wrap, and you just mix it until it becomes cohesive. So you don't want to knead your pie dough. If you knead your pie dough like it's bread dough, you're going to develop gluten, and that gluten is going to make your pie dough more bread-like instead of flaky. So just press it all together to form a cohesive mass, wrap with plastic wrap, and let it chill in the fridge for maybe 20 to 30 minutes. And pie dough will last quite a long time in your refrigerator. So you can make this pie dough a couple of days in advance, right? You can make it today and then use it the day after Thanksgiving. So when you're tired and you don't want to make a mess in the kitchen, this is just a one pot wonder, right? You just put everything in your pot. You're basically reheating vegetables and turkey in gravy. So let's simplify our pot pie down to that. You're reheating your diced turkey and vegetables in your gravy, and then you're checking for final seasoning. You're placing in a casserole pan. Now you have your pre-made pie dough. You're going to roll that out, I don't know, maybe quarter inch, 1/8 inch thickness, and place this over the top of your casserole dish. Crimp the edges just by going around and kind of pinching the pie dough to the edge of the casserole, and you can cut off any excess, but, you know, it's really not necessary to cut that excess off. You just let it roll and you just break it off later. I mean, no one's ever going to complain about having a little bit of extra pie crust on the side. And then what I like to do is I like to brush the pie crust with egg yolks that are thinned with just a tiny bit of water. And using egg yolks instead of the whole egg is going to give you that really nice dark golden brown shiny glaze color, which I think is really pretty. So I'll brush the top of the pie crust with this egg yolk wash, and then I will sprinkle it with large chunks of Malden sea salt. So Malden is a really large, thick crystal sea salt. So I'll sprinkle that across the top. And you'll notice at this point, I haven't put any salt in my pie crust. Now, you can just add like a little pinch, which is always best practice. But I don't, because I like to put a little bit of, or I like to, you know, do fleur de sel, which is a French sea salt, or Maldon sea salt sprinkled over the top of my pie crust. And that gives these really nice little pockets of crunchy salt. From here, your pot pie filling is already hot, right? Because you just simmered it in the gravy. You put it in the casserole dish. You rolled out your pie crust, placed it on top. So now all you need to do is brown your pie crust. You don't have to worry about your pot pie being hot in the center. So 350, 375 in your oven for maybe a half hour. And just check it. When that pie crust is a dark golden brown, and don't be a wimp, all right? A lot of times people pull their pie crust too early. You want to make sure it's a nice, dark, glazy golden brown. Pull it out and serve. Maybe do a nice little like mixed green side salad and keep it simple. Now, another thing that I am going to shoot video on is a turkey and dumpling soup. And the way that you make your dumplings is using your leftover stuffing, right? The stuffing has all sorts of flavor in it. Why not turn those into some amazing dumplings? And here's how you want to do it. Take your stuffing and mash it up in a mixing bowl. You can use a food processor for this too, or you can do it by hand. And you want to add a couple of whole eggs. And enough eggs just to where you're mixing it by hand. The stuffing is noticeably moist, okay? And the eggs are going to give you some protein structure in that stuffing to allow it to set up into dumplings later. Now, once your stuffing is noticeably moist, you're going to start adding in a couple of spoonfuls of flour at a time and just mix the dumplings together, hydrating the flour into the dumplings until it forms a dough that's still wet, but that you could roll into balls. Okay, so just kind of use your eyeballs, use your touch and feel. If the dough is too wet to roll into a ball, then add more flour. Now, if you add too much flour, then your dumplings are going to be more bready. They're not going to be quite as tender, and it's not going to be the end of the world. It's also not going to be ideal. So just keep on adding flour a little bit at a time, stirring it in until you can form balls with the dumpling mix. And to make it easier on yourself, I like to either you can wet your hands in some water, or you can spray your hands with a little bit of nonstick spray, or even coat them in some olive oil and just, you know, rub it together. And then use a large tablespoon, form a dumpling with a large tablespoon, put it in your hand and give it a roll. You can also play around with adding a tiny bit of baking soda, which will make the dumplings a little bit more airy, but it's not really necessary. And I kind of like my dumplings dense. So now you have your turkey stock that we made a couple episodes back, right? Because I'm assuming that you broke down your turkey. Now, if you didn't and you don't have a turkey stock, well, now you have a bunch of bones on Thanksgiving Day. So just go ahead and run your turkey stock overnight with the leftover bones. Now, the next day, strain your turkey stock, bring it up to a simmer, and into that turkey stock, you just want to add whatever vegetables you want. So diced potato, carrot, celery, onions, and cook those vegetables until they reach your preferred doneness. For my soups, I don't really like a bunch of super crunchy vegetables. So it always takes the carrots the longest to cook. So I'll throw in the diced carrots maybe 10 minutes before the rest of my vegetables. And then I'll throw in my celery, diced potatoes, and diced onions, and let those cook for probably another 30 minutes. So you're looking at 45 minutes total. At this point, now all you have to do is place your turkey into the soup to reheat. But because turkey is pretty lean, what we're going to want to do is actually cook our dumplings first. So now we have our dumplings that are made from our leftover stuffing that we've rolled up. Bring that soup to a simmer and start dropping your dumplings in. When your dumplings float, then they're done. It'll probably take about 3 to 4 minutes of simmering for your dumplings to float. Once you've cooked all of your dumplings and they're in your soup, now you want to stir your turkey back in, and now you have a really awesome turkey and dumpling soup, which is going to just be absolutely delicious. All right, before we go, I did get one quick audio comment from SJ Doors, which I'm going to play for you real quick and then discuss.
Hi, Chef. This is Steve from Twitter, at SJ Dorst. Comment on your Thanksgiving Stella Culinary personal story. I've been using a deconstructed turkey recipe since the late 80s when Chef Wolf came out with his New American Turkey. His co-author was the wife of the president of a club I belong to, and I actually got a signed copy in a Christmas raffle. Love doing it, but how do you convince other people to do it? Well, I had no problem convincing my family because we were never big into presentation, and we've cooked it that way ever since. But about once every 4 years, we go down to Southern California for Thanksgiving with another family whose matriarch was, how shall we say, a rather traditionalist. And her turkeys always looked beautiful and tasted horrible. You know, she would sit in the kitchen and, you know, agonize, do I baste or not baste? Do I tent or not tent? And all sorts of other things. Well, 1 year we go down there, and she was laid up sick in her room, and I convinced everybody else to try it the way Chef Wolf presented in his book. And part of that was that you could at least do a partial reconstruction for presentation. And when we served it, you know, she dragged herself out of bed to come to eat with us at the table, and she just couldn't believe how good it was. And so the key, I think, to converting people to a deconstructed recipe is to somehow get them to try it when they don't really know what they're trying. And that convinces them every time. So there you go. Number two on the homework assignment, a personal turkey story.
Awesome, Steve. Thanks so much for chiming in. And yeah, I totally agree. You know, I mean, there's a certain amount of honesty behind food that I love that is very compelling for me personally. Because you put it in your mouth and either it sucks or it doesn't, right? People eat multiple times a day for their entire life. So even people who think that they're not experts on food are at least experts on taste, even if they don't give themselves the credit for it. So it's really hard to pull the wool over somebody's eyes. You might be able to make something look pretty, like that beautiful whole roasted turkey, but when they put it in their mouth, you know, they're going to know right away. It's dry, it's not good, it's stringy, it doesn't have a whole lot of flavor. So that's one of the things that really draws me to cooking, is that honesty in it. And again, just never transgress the one golden rule of cooking, which is your primary ingredient rule. Anything you do to that primary ingredient, whether it's a cooking technique or it's adding flavors, is there only to enhance that primary ingredient. So again, another argument for breaking your turkey down before cooking, separating the parts, or at the very least, spatchcocking it. And that's it for this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. And I guess that's it for our epic Thanksgiving Day series. We really covered a lot, and I'm super pumped. Thanks for being along for the ride. This episode's show notes can be found at stellaculinary.com/scs26, where you can find links to all of the recipes, video techniques, and other resources that I mentioned throughout this episode. You can also friend me on Facebook. That way you can send me a messenger question if you have need of my expertise. If you want to just hang out on the forum, go to stellaculinary.com/forum. You can share your Turkey Day photos, your successes, and do a little bragging. Show off. And until next time, this is Jacob Burton with the Stella Culinary School Podcast, reminding you to cook with passion and have an awesome Thanksgiving holiday.
Hi, Chef. Steve again, at SJ Dorst on Twitter. Not a comment on anything, but a reminder. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, I asked, how do you cut quenelles? Never having been to any kind of a class that showed it, and wanted to hear from you. You promised a short video on it, and as far as I know, that promise is as yet unfulfilled. Hint, hint.
Damn. I think my dog ate my homework? I don't know. Totally forgot. I'll do one soon, maybe in a couple of years. Who knows? Sorry, Steve. Have a great Thanksgiving.